You're listening to Beyond Bourbon Street, an insider's guide to New Orleans. Beyond Bourbon Street is the podcast where we explore the food, music, culture, places, and people that make New Orleans unique. Whether you are planning a trip, living in New Orleans, or simply wanting a taste of the Crescent City from wherever you are, you've come to the right place. And now, your host, Mark Bologna.
Hey, y'all, this is Mark. Welcome to episode 52. The last show was all about small businesses in New Orleans. I interviewed three women who own businesses, including Liz Marty Cook over at Lionheart Prints, Kristen Malone, who owns Home Malone in Mid-City, and Patty Dunn from Chop Industries. They were fun discussions, and all three are great places to shop for gifts for you or anyone who loves New Orleans. If you missed it, go back and give it a listen. I think you'll enjoy it. Today's show is our 52nd, which means we've been at this for 2 years. I'm excited about this one for so many reasons. For one, it's 2 years. It blows my mind the support and the community we've built over these 52 episodes, all around our shared love of New Orleans. On today's episode, I get to share a discussion with you that I had recently with Ben Jaffe. Ben is the band leader of the Preservation Hall Jazz Band, and when I set up this one, I didn't think about it being the 52nd episode, but I couldn't have picked a better guest. As you know, we like to bring you the stories about the people, the places, food, the history, and the culture that makes New Orleans unique. Well, in this episode, we managed to hit all of those things. Ben shares the story of how his parents came to New Orleans and about how the Preservation Hall that we know today came to be. We talk about honor and traditions, about missionary work, about his parents, educating kids, Cuba. We talk about Dave Grohl and the Foo Fighters, and a whole lot more. I'm proud to bring you this interview with Ben Jaffe of Preservation Hall, so let's get to it. All right, well, my guest today is Ben Jaffe. Ben is the creative director, among other things, at Preservation Hall. And while I'm certain that you've heard of Preservation Hall, today we're going to dig a little bit into the history, the musicians, the music, give you the insider scoop on all things Preservation Hall from past and today. Thank you so much, Ben, for doing this.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for what you do.
I'm so excited to bring to the listeners Preservation Hall and the story of your parents that we'll get into, and the musicians. As we were talking before we came on, I think that most people certainly know of Preservation Hall. Maybe you've come in to see a show, but we want to give them a little bit of taste of the history and all of that. So let's just kind of jump in with, how did Preservation Hall come to be?
This was originally, well, I should say when my parents first came here in 1961, and they were from Pennsylvania. My mom's from Philadelphia. My dad's from a small town outside Philadelphia, a little coal mining town called Pottsville, Pennsylvania. And they met in Philadelphia, and that's where they were living. And my dad was working at a department store in Philadelphia. And they came to New Orleans part of they called it a honeymoon. It was definitely during that honeymoon period of their life, you know, in their 20s, and you know, things were fresh and new, and everything was a new experience. You know, every day the sun came up, it was like for the first time. You know, it was that period of your life, and they had gone down to Mexico, and were living in Mexico City for a period of time, and we're driving back to Philadelphia and came through New Orleans. And my dad had a college buddy who is from New Orleans and had gone to school with him up in Philadelphia. So he came through New Orleans knowing that they knew somebody here already. And it didn't take them long to, you know, discover the French Quarter, you know, at that time.
And I kind of jumped into like this big question, but your parents, Alan and Sandra Jaffe, they got married. They were young. Was your dad in the military before they got married?
Yes. Yeah. My dad had actually gone to Valley Forge Military Academy on a music scholarship in high school. And then he, through like the ROTC program, went to Wharton, the University of Pennsylvania. And when he got out of school, he was actually came down to Louisiana, to Fort Polk, Louisiana. That was actually his first time coming down here. was he was doing his training, his officer training at Fort Polk, Louisiana. Yeah, and that was like his first time coming down to Louisiana and New Orleans.
Yeah, Fort Polk, couple hours west, but a whole different part of Louisiana, a whole different world.
Yeah.
And so then they come back, they get married, they're on this sort of honeymoon period.
Yeah, and they come through New Orleans. My dad was a musician. He was a tuba player. And, you know, something that's just culturally interesting and just kind of puts things into, like, perspective is there had been this New Orleans jazz revival that had taken place in the 1950s. You know, New Orleans jazz had kind of had its heyday.
Sure.
You know, with Louis Armstrong in you know, Jelly Roll Morton in the, you know, the early part of the 20th century. And then it had fallen sort of out of fashion.
Right.
You know, I mean, if you think about it, you know, New Orleans style jazz was the popular music of its time. I mean, it was pop music.
Right, right. You
know? And like anything that's popular, it becomes unpopular, you know. So it had gone through this period where it had fallen off a lot of people's radar, and then was swinging back around again. And these people like my mom and dad, who weren't alive during the heyday, you know, who sure. kind of discovered the Louis Armstrong Hot 5 and Hot 7 albums later on in life, were responsible, like these teenagers and these college students were responsible for bringing back or bringing attention to New Orleans jazz. And there was like a whole movement along the East Coast called actually called the New Orleans Jazz Revival.
Really?
Yeah, that happened in the 50s. And that was kind of what my dad got swept up into. And that's all the parties. It would be like a little jazz band playing like New Orleans jazz songs, you know.
Well, and I think it's really interesting, as you mentioned. So your parents come through New Orleans in the early 60s, and jazz is on the upswing, but it had just been through this period of it wasn't like you see today
No.
in New Orleans. You come to Preservation Hall, you go to plenty of places, and you can hear traditional jazz and riffs on jazz, but that wasn't the way here.
No, absolutely not. I mean, when my parents, you know, my parents get to New Orleans, and what they discover is there aren't a lot of opportunities to actually hear New Orleans style jazz in New Orleans, you know,
right.
And I mean, along Bourbon Street, you might catch a band playing it at one of the dance, you know, like one of the burlesque clubs at like, you know,
right.
Or,
sure.
you know, but it was always secondary or tertiary, you know, to selling drinks and, or whatever else the business was, you know, like
right.
Music was not the primary reason for the business existing. It was like a background, you know, as an ornament
sure.
to what was going on.
Well, and as I understand it, even and we'll get into it a little bit, the history here was that it was originally Preservation Hall. People think of it, and it's an old building, but Preservation Hall as we know it today was created in the 60s with your parents. But that predecessor to that was really Larry Borenstein.
Yes.
Having these, they call them rehearsals or sit-ins?
Yeah, well, that's what my parents came into.
Okay.
This location was a gallery. What is now Preservation Hall was an art gallery, and the entire building, like now you know we're sitting back here in my parents' old apartment, you can actually see that it's a lot, you know, the building, the whole kind of facility
yeah.
is bigger than the actual hall itself,
right,
you know,
we'll get into it, but the hall itself is 700 square feet,
yeah, very very small, very intimate. And that's what they came in, that's what they walked into. They walked into this gallery space where you could come and interact with artists. And that was something that Larry Borenstein created. He created this space that people could visit and actually watch artists at work painting portraits. And often they would be painting portraits of jazz musicians who they would bring in to either sit for the portraits, and that sort of grew into what they called rehearsal sessions, because it was the Jim Crow South. You
sure.
know? You know, there wasn't, it, you know, unless you were placed on Bourbon Street selling drinks, you know, there wasn't, it wasn't acceptable.
Sure, and from what I read, so it was an art gallery, which meant that they weren't licensed to have musical shows.
Right,
right.
Correct.
You couldn't pay to have someone come in. And I just think the juxtaposition of all that you mentioned, you're in the heart of the Jim Crow South, so very much segregated. They don't have a license to sell tickets for music. So it feels very much what you're describing, what I've read, is sort of an artist collective.
Yeah.
I know, by the way, we're into music and we're into to jazz, and so we're going to get musicians in here. We're going to take some, do some drawings and paintings. And by the way, they'll probably jam and gig, and we'll invite some people just to come on in and hang out.
Yeah, but it was, you know, as I've discovered is, you know, that if you, as long as you're flying under the flag of art, you know, you are given a lot of freedom.
Sure.
You know, and that's, I mean, it's as true today as it's ever been, you know, and that's what, you know, my parents really came to understand, is that this wasn't just a musical movement. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't just a preservation of a style of music. You know, it was almost as if the creation of Preservation Hall was really just the flag.
Sure.
You know, that they were all, you know, doing this other as important or more important work under, which was to, you know, create a open musical setting for musicians and for audiences. And it was the first of its kind. And even to this day, there's really nothing that is like Preservation Hall in New Orleans. You find like elements of it. And I should say, it's not just New Orleans. It's really anywhere. I mean, like, if there was another place but like New Preservation Hall, we would have heard about it by now.
Right.
You know what I mean? No one's saying like, hey, I'm going to Argentina to go to this place. It's just, or hey, there's this place in Japan, or man, this place in New York, it's been around for 50 years. And it's, you know, there's the Village Vanguard, or there's, you know, the Blue Note, and there's like jazz venues, but they're not Preservation Hall. And that's not to be, it's not competitive, and not to compare the two, because there's nothing to compare there.
Right.
Preservation Hall is really unique, and you have to see beyond like the music to really understand that Preservation Hall was a movement and is a movement.
Well, and that's exactly why I wanted to do this episode, that again, people may have, and we'll certainly get into the actual concerts and coming in to sit in the front room there. But even when you're in there in that small space, it feels like you're coming into something that's bigger than just the hearing a concert. Because you often will hear, and this is fading out, obviously, as the musicians pass, but the history and this tie into the legacy, and also this idea of spinning that forward and letting it morph.
Yeah,
it
sounds like what Preservation Hall accomplished and what my parents achieved was this recognition for this very important cultural art form. And what it managed to do is bring to people's attention it brought an awareness to this tradition that existed in New Orleans that was still fairly young in the 60s. You know, jazz was still a young tradition. I mean, if you think about, like, you know, how long we've had Western classical music, and how long it took, you know, for that to just go from, you know, a church into, you know, an opera house, or, you know, a theater, and, you know, like La Scala, you know, to where it was like regarded as an art form. I mean, jazz really only was only just becoming recognized as an important American and African American art form.
So much so that when your parents were here and then created Preservation Hall, you had those early musicians had direct ties back to Buddy Bolden and not far removed from those original musicians that were playing.
Some of them predated Buddy Bolden.
Really?
You know, I mean, Papa John Joseph had played with Buddy Bolden. You know, that's unbelievable to me. I mean, you know, my parents, fortunately, because of Larry Bornstein and the environment and the community of people that he attracted, my parents met people like Bill Russell. Wow. And met, you know, these people who were the pioneers of the study of New Orleans jazz.
Well, you know, and that's to your point about things like classical music and opera, and right, to have that direct relation, your point of just now Preservation Hall, 50 plus years old, but going back from there 50 plus years back, you were right in the heart of that movement. What did it mean to those musicians that, that your parents helped create and foster and continue this opportunity for them?
It was a salvation.
Yeah.
You know, it gave them a platform to perform in a way that they never had before. They had never been able to perform music in front of an appreciative audience in that regard before. You know, it's very different to play at a carnival ball or to play at a Mardi Gras parade or to play at, you know, a St. Charles lawn party or at, you know, a lot of people, you know, say, hey, you know, Sweet Emma played at my fraternity party at Tulane in, you know, 1950, you know, and those are the stories I hear. And, you know, Papa Celestine played at all of our Christmas parties and, you know, and it's another thing to get the experience of hearing a musician play music the way that people pray in church in New Orleans. Which is something very personal and something that that's for yourself. You're not performing for somebody, you're performing for yourself and for the congregation. And that's something that, that very few people actually ever get to witness or see. You know, very few people, especially, you know, particularly if you're, you know, not from New Orleans, and if you don't grow up in the African-American sort of church tradition, that's a world that you don't get access to.
Sure.
That's a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful thing that we have that there are traditions that are special and are things that you're born into in New Orleans, you know. And that's what Preservation Hall created, was what these musicians got to experience for themselves in church, performing, you know, for the spiritual value of the performance. They got to do that at Preservation Hall for the very first time. They got to play music for themselves in front of an audience that wanted them to be honest about their music. They didn't want them to necessarily, you know, play all the hits.
Sure.
They wanted them to play the blues.
Right.
You know, they wanted them to, what do you play? What do you play when you're playing for yourself? That's what we want to hear now. That's what my parents wanted to hear.
Sure.
They wanted to hear like that honesty, and that was really Preservation Hall provided, was like this environment, this like safe environment that encouraged these musicians to like the way that Newport Folk Festival did for a lot of, like, you know, for Mahalia Jackson and for for all of these, you know, early blues artists like Lightning Hopkins and, you know, all of those early artists, you know, and, you know, for a lot of them, they just kind of, you know, these artists, at first you kind of scratch your head and you're like, well, this is just what I play when I'm on my porch.
Right.
You're like, exactly. Like, you know, that's like when you go out to a great Cajun restaurant or something. Like, I want you, what do you eat at home? You know, like when we go to, like, you know, to a restaurant, I mean, I want to eat what you guys
exactly
eat. What do you eat?
So that's the whole impetus for Beyond Bourbon Street and Insider's Guide, is exactly that. People saying, well, what do you cook at home? What do you guys eat? Where would you take somebody?
Exactly.
To go?
Yeah.
I heard a recent interview you did on NPR with the World Cafe, and you had the touring band with you. And one of the things you were talking about was a second line, and trying to explain to people in that forum that a second line is immersive. So you not only have the band playing and they're doing their thing, certainly in past times, for themselves, for their community, and people are joining in, and there's really no discernment. You're elbow to elbow if you're playing an instrument. You're elbow to elbow sometimes with the crowd. And as I heard that interview, it struck me that that's the exact same experience you have in the front room here at Preservation Hall. As you're talking about, the musicians are playing, but you're so close, you're so intimate, you are almost elbow to elbow, you're almost feet touching, sometimes feet are touching if it's really crowded in there at night, and you very much feel like, as an audience member, that you're just getting to eavesdrop, you're getting to sit in with people playing their music for the love of the music and riffing off of each other, and that's what really struck me, even now, about what you're saying, that's what it feels like.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the, like, innocent, you know, things my parents created, was this experience. I mean, they really, Preservation Hall grew out of their innocence.
Sure.
You know, and their, you know, their like their ability to, you know, discern between to just have this ability. I mean, certain people in music and in art are attracted to like the pure.
Sure.
And they're attracted to like these, the, just these things that kind of rise above everything. And those were the things that my parents were attracted to, like whether it was, you know, the visual arts or, you know, photography or writing. I mean, those were, you know, and they had like these great guides who helped them shape, you know,
sure.
Help them shape their tastes and help them be discerning and help them like make a distinction between, you know, certain things. And that's like so nuanced that you really don't even understand it unless you're in it.
Well, and you say that, and again, you've taken me back into the apartment where your parents lived, right behind what most of us know as Preservation Hall. And just looking around the room, you can feel that in a way that's maybe hard to describe in words. But I see art that's probably pre-Columbian or Mexican, and Larry Lowenstein certainly probably had an influence there. And I see all the pictures of musicians and the art, and just even we have the blinds closed, but the light coming in, it feels like that kind of feeling that transfers up to up front.
They were, my parents didn't grow up like the sons and daughters of artists. They grew up the sons and daughters of immigrants.
Sure.
You know, of like, you know, Russian Jewish immigrants. And they grew up with, I think that, you know, part of like their Jewish upbringing was an appreciation and admiration and respect for the arts.
Sure.
You know, and that was something that it's just integrated into who you are. It's the singing in synagogue. It's the singing at home. It's the formality to the ceremony of the holidays and all of these things. There's like ritual. And, you know, my dad's military background, you know, he was very much about pomp and circumstance and loved brass bands and loved that they were, you know, these military style outfits and the hats and the formality of the ties and the white pressed shirts and the shine shoes. I mean, Dad reacted to all of that, you know, and he understood it. Like he understood that thinking, you know,
sure.
that it made the musicians puff their chests out a little bit more. And it also, you know, gave the audience and the members of the community pride in, you know, looking out their doors and opening their shutters and you know, saying, I mean, even today, like, you know, when a social aid and pleasure club comes out, you know, everybody, you know, we'll immediately talk about, you know, the shoes they're wearing and like the outfits and like, oh boy, don't they look pretty? You know, look at those Indians. Don't they look pretty today? Boy, look at them, you know, like, oh man, you know, and that's something that pride, like, sticks with you for the year. You got a year to carry that forward till the next second line or the next Mardi Gras, and then you got to re-up, you know. you got to outdo yourself, you know. You got to look just as pretty as you did from the year before.
Well, it's interesting to hear you tie that and thinking about your dad's military background. As you were talking, I was thinking about the Olympia brass.
Yeah.
And just always, they're the ones that just struck me. There are many, many that do that with the everything just so, and the ties and the shoes and the white hats and the caps. But you alluded to, and you talked about Mardi Gras Indians. We've done a couple episodes about Mardi Gras Indians, and the idea of you're so pretty is such a hard thing to describe to someone that's not from here or hasn't grown up in the culture. But the way that Mardi Gras Indian chiefs decide who's the prettiest or who's the best is they meet on the streets, Mardi Gras morning or St. Joseph's night or Easter, and they size up the prettiness and they say, you're so pretty.
Yeah.
And saying he's the prettiest is about the highest honor you can give someone.
Oh, yeah.
In a second line or a Mardi Gras Indian gang.
Oh, I mean, that's the high honor.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like, you unless you think that you're the prettiest, you shouldn't even bother coming out. Yeah, leave the house.
And you're right. Then they do it all again. They discard those suits for the most part, and they start all over again. But it reminds me when you come
and there's,
into,
that's, you know, there's pride in that.
Yeah,
you know, that's something, and that was something that my father was attracted to, and I think musicians, you know, these, you know, Creole African American musicians like Harold Dejean and, you know, the Olympia Brass Band, they they appreciated that in my dad for noticing that.
Sure.
You know, and then also for helping to make that vision, you know, to help them realize that vision,
right.
You know, and to like care enough about it to say, you know, this is important to me. I'm like, I'm going to show up pretty to to the gig, you know, cause this is like, it's your tradition. I'm just honored to
honor it.
And I'm also honoring your tradition. And I'm also honored that you're allowing me to be a part of your tradition.
That takes you right back to this idea of the context and the time is so important. I think, you could argue today again with all that's going on in the world, but if you try to set yourself back into the early 1960s, it was impossible in a lot of cases. People, particularly in the African American community and in New Orleans, I'm sure elsewhere, didn't have the forum to do that. Right? They were certainly proud and shared their music and their traditions internally and in their own culture, but there weren't a lot of opportunities for that to be displayed honored.
Yeah, you had to get that affirmation from people in your community, because in a split second, you could be made to feel like like dirt, and every older musician and every older African American male that I know in New Orleans, you don't even have to be that old,
right?
It's part of their experience. They'll talk about being on Canal Street, and maybe being dressed like they're going to church, and a police officer or someone in a store or someone sweeping the sidewalk will you could be in Treme or the 7th Ward or 8th Ward or Claiborne or like Orleans and walking around and people coming out say, well, you look look at you today, look, is it your birthday, and and then you could be on Canal Street and and next thing you could get kicked. Or you can get, yelled at, or someone could say something to you that'll make you feel,
it's
just very insulting.
Sure.
Incredibly insulting, and you don't even have recourse
as
a human being. That makes you feel less than human. Or you can just, have like the thickness, have such thick skin, and you develop that thick skin generation after generation,
sure,
that you smile and just realize that that's not even your problem.
Sure.
Well,
while your parents were creating this opportunity for people both to honor their tradition and be honored by having people come, I imagine they must have experienced some harassment from the community and from the police and the city at that time.
Yeah, it was like There were a lot of forces at work.
Sure.
There was a large community. I mean, just like we experienced after Hurricane Katrina, there was a large community of outsiders.
Right.
Who always existed in New Orleans. Larry Bornstein wasn't from here. He was from Chicago, and Bill Russell wasn't from here, and a lot of the artists that we associate with New Orleans weren't from here. Gypsy Lou wasn't from here, and Noel Rockmore, who did all these, all the portraits, wasn't from here. It's interesting because we associate these people with New Orleans so much that it's easy to forget that oftentimes it takes an outsider with a kind of a clean slate and a fresh perspective to appreciate what is right before your eyes.
Right. See that in our culinary history too.
Yes.
Paul Prudhomme from Louisiana, but not from New Orleans, and comes from Cajun country and introduces what we now think of as sort of New Orleans food, but Cajun food didn't exist here really.
No.
In that form. You look at Emeril today, right? Emeril's not from New Orleans. We've adopted him.
Right.
But he's come in and brought his own culture and honored the traditions and made them his own.
And so that's part of, what my parents, were able to do. And I think as outsiders, they were able to, they were able to come to New Orleans without any preconceived notions. And they were also able to come here without any existing relationships, which is also, a challenge. If if you're from here and go to school here,
right,
we all know it's like, you can't go to school in New Orleans and not end up knowing everybody.
Right.
You know?
Right. You and I were talking before we came on about you just trying to get your daughter to school and you get stopped, right?
10 times. Right. Yeah. I mean, and not even by people who are like at school. Right. You know, so it's like someone driving down the street honking their horn, like, you know, hey, Jeff, and he stopped. I mean, but that's the beautiful part. That is a beautiful part of New Orleans. And that's one of the, you know, those things that you have that we always are trying to keep in balance here.
Sure. You know? Well, and you mentioned Katrina, and so, you know, we'll jump forward many years. So your parents take over, they create what is now Preservation Hall in the early 60s. And what's interesting to me about something you just said is New Orleanians tend to be parochial and say, well, you know, you sort of have to earn your merit badge, if you will, to be a New Orleanian. But the reality is New Orleans has always been made up of people coming in, whether it's
from day one.
From day one, right? Yeah. And obviously New Orleans, there were people here when what we think of as New Orleans was founded.
Yes.
So there was this clash, you know, with Native American Indians and newcomers coming. And then you've had obviously the slave trade and immigrants and laborers and people moving because they want to move. And so to me, it's a sort of false narrative to say, well, we're the New Orleanians. New Orleans and all the goodness of it is built upon those clashes. And
I mean,
I've met
New Orleanians and California that have never been to New Orleans.
Right.
You know?
Absolutely.
I mean, I've been all over the world and I'll be like, oh man, that you are straight. You are like, no doubt. We were in Cuba and I was like, I mean, you can move the entire city of Santiago to New Orleans and it wouldn't skip a beat, you know? And you can move New Orleans to Santiago and we wouldn't skip a beat either. I mean, it's you realize that there's a certain spirit.
Sure.
To being a New Orleanian. And I do ascribe to that, you know, it's not so much about you have to earn your badge to be here, but you have to come. There are certain sacred, holy places in this world that you have to go to with your head bowed.
I think it's back to your point of view. Yeah. You have to honor the traditions and be willing to honor what's going on.
Yes,
right?
And respectful of it. And also, you can't be a bystander. You also can't be a voyeur. You know, you can't kind of suck the life out of something. You have to infuse it with life. And that's a like something that you don't naturally, some people don't naturally understand because in the community that they grew up in, that's not even on their radar. You know,
sure.
What I mean, like most people are just like trying to wake up and get to work.
Right.
You know, so they, like, what are you talking about? Like sometimes they're, you know, I'll have a conversation with somebody about this in an informative way. You know, well, I don't even know what that means. Well, this is what it means, you know, is when you come to New Orleans, you don't live in a castle.
Right. We expect it to be an immersive
experience.
Yeah.
If I don't run into you out on the street, then you're not really a New Orleanian. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
absolutely.
Yeah. Like, I don't even know. Like, if I don't bump into you on a regular basis, then I don't understand what you're even doing here.
Right. I had to explain to someone the other day I was late because I ran into a second line, which of course meant you don't just sit in your car. You get out and you participate.
Oh, you have to. I mean, then, either that or you're going to just lose your mind.
Exactly.
You know, especially if you have to get somewhere.
And then I ran into someone and then someone handed me a drink.
Yeah.
And, right. And that's part of life.
The same thing. We flew in. We were flying back from a show. And I think it was like, God, we were like far away. We were in Los Angeles and it was a long flight and it was a long night and we were exhausted. And you get back and I remember just being like, man, I hope there's not a Saints game at the Dome. Cause that's like that's one piece of traffic. Or if there is a Saints game, hopefully it's going on right now so that like I can just get home,
exactly.
You know? And you're just like, you know, you're trying to figure these things out. And then I was like, okay, great. Game is actually out of town. Cool. Everybody's home watching the game. Great. No traffic. Great. You know, my wife and kid are, you know, they're at the Audubon Zoo or something. And I'm just going to sail home, get home, take a shower, wash my clothes, get ready. And sure enough, man, I'm getting closer to like the Esplanade exit. And like, as soon as I made that turn on the exit, I like hit myself in the head and I was like, oh, second line. And sure enough, man, like as soon as I hit Claiborne Avenue, it was like, you know, I just pulled over on the parking lot right there, just parked the car, got out, you know, went over, knew everybody.
You do what
you
do.
But it was just one of those things where I was like, smooth sailing, second line.
Life in New Orleans.
Yeah.
Well, and you mentioned, You mentioned in passing Hurricane Katrina, and one of the many things that, well, really going back to your dad, it seemed like your dad very early on decided to help grow this movement and spread the idea that there had to be a tour. They had to get musicians out of New Orleans and get them out and show them the world, but let the world see them and get immersed.
Absolutely.
In the experience.
I mean, it's part of the missionary aspect of what Preservation Hall does, which is this, you know, traveling work. I mean, we don't just go to one place. I mean, we're everywhere we travel, there's like these revivals.
Sure.
You know, like every concert is kind of like these spiritual revivals that, you know, these reminders of the goodness, you know, of like humanity.
Well, it feels to me like you're exporting what we've been talking about for the last half hour about life in New Orleans and trying to give somebody for a couple hours on a random night somewhere.
And Preservation Hall ended up doing it. You know, Preservation Hall, interestingly, used as a model people like Fats Domino.
Sure.
Who was really, at that time, the only... there were very few artists from New Orleans who were really on the like touring circuit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and race had a lot to do with that. You know, if you were Lee Dorsey or Ernie Cato or, you know, Smiley Lewis. I mean, earlier, if you know Smiley Lewis, and, you know, this is like even before, you know, Alan Toussaint and Irma Thomas and, you know, Dr. John and, like, you know, the Meters really hit the scene. There really wasn't a circuit for like a Fats Domino to mm-hmm. play. I mean, he sure. wasn't playing in concert halls.
Right.
He would have to kind of find like the Doudrop Inn of Memphis.
Sure.
You know, you'd have to be aware of these circuits, and there was a black circuit.
Right. There was a black guide, like a mobile guide kind of thing.
Yeah. And, you know, so there were like these venues that black artists could play in. And what Preservation Hall interestingly did was, because of the timing of it all, and because my parents, you know, Fats is touring in the 50s, so he's like right in the middle of like the Jim Crow civil rights thing, and, you know, and then my parents get in here in 61 and get invited to start performing places. They receive invitations, bring your band to this concert hall, and it was very different than it being a business. It became a project. And when I say missionary work, it was like, it really was. It was like, oh, we are bringing an African American band to a performing arts stage. And that was a major, major statement. There weren't that many artists. I mean, you could pretty much count them. I mean, if you just go back and look at, like, you know, touring artists of the 50s and, you know, early 60s, they weren't African American artists. There were very few, and if there were, they were mostly in classical music, or maybe there was an opera singer, or maybe there was like a band like a James Reese Europe style band, like out of New York, that was more like a military kind of John Philip Sousa type of band. But you know, because of the timing of the civil rights movement and our country's kind of awareness of jazz, all sort of happening all at the same time.
Right.
This was all like, everything was just like happening right then. Korea moving into like Vietnam, and, you know, John F. Kennedy, and like the Cuban Missile Crisis and the assassination, and Martin Luther King and Pete Seeger and Newport. Like, the impact that Newport Folk Festival and Jazz Festival had on this country is not truly understood and recognized. But we were not a country with music festivals. This is like before the Jazz Fest.
Right. I was going to ask you.
You know, this was before Jazz Fest. I mean, Newport is the reason we have a Jazz Fest.
Right, exactly.
You know?
And I wonder how much your parents and Lowenstein and the formation of Preservation Hall, I'm sure it had to help create the impetus. I know they were all there at the beginning of the
Absolutely.
Idea of Jazz Fest.
I mean, Newport had a huge impact on my parents, and so did Pete Seeger, so did Bob Dylan. I mean, my father would have been the same age as Bob Dylan, so they were very much inspired by the same musics. Bob was from, you know, Minnesota, so, and he was more inspired by sort of like this acoustic folk tradition, And whereas my dad was more inspired by the, you know, this jazz, this, you know, New Orleans jazz tradition,
sure,
and military marching band tradition and gospel and whatnot. But they were pretty much like cut from the same cloth.
Right.
My dad was an organizer, you know, and maybe more like Pete Seeger in that way. Mm-hmm. You know, Pete Seeger was the one who helped organize the first Newport Festival,
sure,
with George Ween. And that was incredibly influential. That was like the most important sort of musical cultural events of that decade.
Well, I was talking to a high school buddy, Vance Fokerson,
yeah,
not long ago, and he was talking about his parents, and I think his parents' place was owned by Lowenstein, the building itself not far from,
yeah,
here.
Well, I think they had like the Creole Cafe or something, right, like next door. Actually, I think there was like a door like here in the wall. I'll show it to you on the way out. There was like a door.
Really?
Yeah, Fokerson's, yeah, like, because my dad was friends. Yeah, they were all friends.
Were
and
all
like
friends.
The first jazz fest that they had in New Orleans, Fokerson used to supply all the hot sausage for Buster Holmes.
Okay.
And Buster's used to be over on Orleans,
sure,
and Burgundy. And that was like the go-to place.
Yep.
If you were in the French Quarter, it was either Fokerson's or Buster's for beans. For beans and rice, you went to,
right,
Buster's.
Exactly. Well, I bring it up because, yeah, you had all these people. So you think about, and Fokerson's today the longest and the only original vendor at Jazz Fest,
yeah,
from those first days. But your parents and Lowenstein and the Fokerson's, all of that comes together like you're talking about. If all that doesn't swirl just the right way against just the right cultural,
exactly,
moment, we don't have Jazz Fest. And you think about,
exactly,
the impact. And I had never thought about you guys and the touring that you do from a missionary aspect. But I want to certainly talk about the foundation and the good that you guys do. But it strikes me that mission work is very much what that is.
Well, you can do missionary work, and it doesn't have to be religious.
Right.
You,
sure,
know, it can be. It's inspirational.
Sure.
You know, and it can be joyful, and sometimes, you know, that's what it feels like we're doing is bringing attention and awareness to, you know, this cultural art form and tradition, expanding that tradition and kind of helping it, you know, grow into its new skin, you know, as you know, every generation has to like grow into a tradition,
sure,
you know, and that's just up to that generation to figure out what that is, you know. And then, you know, going out and performing, I mean, it's really why we do what we do, is because it is inspiring, you know, and not only is it, do we see the way our music touches people and the joy it brings into their life, but the amount of joy it brings into our lives, it allows us to really push forward, you know, under all circumstances. I mean, through Hurricane Katrina, it was music that got us through. It,
sure,
it was people's love of our music. It was the strength of music. It was the strength of other musicians from New Orleans and outside New Orleans that got us through that very, very like deep, dark, you know, chunk of our lives. I mean, that was a big piece of our lives. That wasn't just like 6 months, man. That was like 8 years,
right,
of our lives.
Yeah,
you know,
one of my most memorable positive moments after Katrina, and there were many in the midst of that, was that first Jazz Fest after, and of all people, seeing Bruce Springsteen come on,
yes,
and have done his research. That was the very start. I think it was the beginning of the Seeger sessions, and he came out, and when they he had done his research, and he played When the Saints Go Marching In, but he played the second, third, and I think fourth verses that even most New Orleanians
don't know. Right, or just kind of have like disappeared over time.
Right?
Yeah.
We've adopted it, obviously, as the New Orleans Saints, and you don't. And it was just so touching on so many,
yeah,
levels, that it was music bringing community
together. It was,
together.
And we had just finished our set at Economy Hall, you know, and I'm a huge Bruce Springsteen. I mean, I wouldn't say fan is even the right word, because I was in like fifth or sixth grade, and I was a friend in Pennsylvania when I used to travel with the band when I was a kid. My father would just put us on the bus and we'd all go.
Sure.
It was like a, you know, big gypsy caravan. And I remember getting that record for the first time, Born to Run, and just falling in love with whatever this person and this band. I didn't even understand what it was, you know. I was like, there's something here. Like, this guy's, like, you know, he's a New Orleanian, I, you know,
yeah,
what I mean? It's like,
And it felt that way that day. On
and
that
we
stage.
Had just gone off stage, and like I grabbed my tuba and I was like hauling butt to get over to Springsteen. And like as I was getting up, I heard them. We had just played the Saints Go Marching In on our stage, and I hear him echoing it on the, you know, on the main stage. And I had to put my tuba down and just find a corner to kind of curl up into a ball. Cause it was that powerful and emotional of a moment.
It was a lot of that in the crowd. And I remember being able to look up while that was going on and you could see blue tarps in the neighborhood.
Yes.
Right. You know?
Yeah.
It's emotional talking about it, but it was the music and the food and the community of that day that really struck me as this is a bright spot in a tough, as you said, years long, you know, recovery still arguably going through.
Yes.
And it was the music. And I think you mentioned being touched as you guys travel. I know you guys had the opportunity to go to Cuba. And what is that like in terms of influencing you guys?
Cuba's culturally one of the most important places on earth. It's, you know, like New Orleans. When my parents came in 61, you know, New Orleans really felt untouched by the hands of time. You know, even today, people land here and they feel like they're in another country. You know,
sure.
once you cross the parish line,
yep.
You know, once you get into the French Quarter and you get uptown and you get into mid-city and you start feeling the city and you get down to the Bywater, you're like, okay, this is we're in a different world here. Mm-hmm. This isn't the United States anymore. And that's what you feel when you go to Cuba is you feel as if time has that parts of the culture are captured in a snapshot of time.
Sure.
And you know that you don't necessarily feel like you're going back in time, but you just feel like you're inside of a photograph from, you know, we're all living in the, you know, in whatever, you know, November 30th, 2017, but really this is like, you know, some other moment in time that's not really even on a calendar, because there's modern things and there's old things and there's like art is art. It's timeless.
Sure.
So, you know, nobody's like, you know, we can't fool ourselves and think that we're like playing scales any better today than we did like 300 years ago.
Right. Right.
You know, so there are musicians there that, you know, are world class musicians.
Sure.
You know, and it's in their blood. It's in their soul. I mean, it's the same cultural and like roots as New Orleans in many ways, you know, just in a different balance. You know, you find the Spanish, you'll find the French, and you'll find, you know, the African presence in,
sure.
in the country in different proportions throughout the country. You know, imagine like if New Orleans was like a whole country.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like
yeah,
if New
yeah,
Orleans, if like it. If New Orleans wasn't just New Orleans, but like New Orleans was the size of
I can see almost the neighborhoods if you enlarge all the neighborhoods, right?
Exactly. If you just like if you like proportionally just like made every neighborhood bigger.
Right, right.
Yeah, you would have like the whole
you
country. Yes, absolutely. Like yeah, Santiago is definitely like the 7th and 8th ward.
Okay.
Yeah, and then like, you know, Havana's more like, you know, kind of like the uptown 13th ward, you know.
That's an interesting one. It struck me at going back to Jazz Fest again. Jazz Fest for many years has featured the music of a different country. And this past year at Jazz Fest, they featured the music of Cuba.
Yes.
And there was a moment I was walking, because right there you can get your meat pies, a little plug, and not far away, the Yacamain. So I was walking by at the same moment. There was someone on the Cuban stage in the tent, and a second line was going by. And you're very close to a couple of stages that feature jazz predominantly. And it all sort of blended together. And I just stood there for a moment and thought, these beats, this sort of Afro-Caribbean feel that you're hearing in the tent to my left, you can trace it directly. You can feel the syncopation.
Oh, yeah.
And so there was this moment of hearing the Cuban music on my left, the second line on my right. And when you close your eyes and blend it all together, what hit me was, boy, it sounds like George Porter and the Nevilles and the Meters. And it just for this
right.
moment was like, boy, it's all that, all those rhythms and things that come from the people that have been here before us all meld into New Orleans music.
Well, that's something that like New Orleans musicians have known forever. You know, like, I mean, that's something that Jelly Roll Morton knew. I mean, right. He talked about the Spanish tinge in New Orleans music. I mean, that you can hear it in the rumba. I mean, you can hear it in Professor Longhair. I mean, nobody's like trying to be like, we came up with that. You know, right. I mean, right. What we did is we took all of this, and this is what comes out of it when you put it through a New Orleans filter.
Sure.
You know, but when you take all of this and put it through a Cuban filter, it's unbelievable what comes out there too. What's important to me is understanding really how thick and important the relationship is between New Orleans and Cuba and Haiti, and that those are really New Orleans, Cuba, and Haiti are really the three locations, the three places that impacted one another.
Sure.
It's kind of equally.
Yeah.
And also have the most similar histories or interconnected histories.
Sure.
You know, after the revolution in Haiti, I mean, New Orleans absorbed, you know, thousands of Haitians, you know, or it wasn't even Haiti at the time, it was Santo Domingo or Santo Domingue. And then, all of the trade that we had with Cuba, and the relationship, I mean, you go back to the 1850s and you're going to see that, like, you know, Gottschalk from New Orleans is going to Cuba, you know, a New Orleans, you know, a Jewish New Orleans classical composer trained in France is living in Cuba,
sure,
composing songs and like incorporating African drums into orchestral music, then bringing that orchestral music back to New Orleans. You know, that's psychedelic. You know what I mean?
you see it in our food and our music.
Oh yeah, absolutely, man. In New Orleans, everybody's like, when we go to Cuba and like in Haiti, it's like you're like, and even and in Brazil too, but in Cuba and Haiti, it's like it smells like New Orleans. It tastes like New Orleans. It feels like New Orleans. It just,
right,
you know, and yeah, that's part of like what the work that our foundation does, mm-hmm, is it supports that part of the band's experience. You know, mm-hmm, it's not just important to me to provide an experience. It's important for the musicians, the members of our collective, to also have that experience so that they can continue to grow as artists. Mm. You know,
sure,
unless you continue to grow as an artist, right, then like you're going to find that your tradition is going to like stagnate. And like once a tradition stagnates and becomes a museum piece, it starts collecting dust and it starts becoming something that you don't even have control over anymore. It becomes something other people want it to be, and that's something that you are.
That's,
you know,
that's fascinating, and I want to honor your time. But saying that, it doesn't cause me to want to touch on, gosh, maybe right after Katrina, you made a deliberate decision, I'm sure with others, to start to interact more with modern artists, right? And I say modern artists. You guys have done some collaborations, probably most famously and most recently with the Foo Fighters and their Sonic Highways project, but U2's The Edge and Alabama Shakes and plenty of them. And I imagine, I know that you got some criticism for that, but it feels to me like hearing you say that, that's exactly how you continue a tradition and add to it and help it grow.
Oh yeah.
And help
grow. Well, what the biggest challenge for me is recognizing that this is not my tradition. You know, that's the hardest, sure, part for me, is that I've attained a certain position in life and a certain position here at Preservation Hall and amongst musicians that I can help shape, mm-hmm, the direction of certain things, you know. Jerry Wexler was like the producer at Atlantic Records and made some of the best, you know, soul records of all times. And, you know, it wouldn't have happened without, you know, this person behind the scenes who was helping shape the direction of things. You know, sometimes, yeah, I mean, I know this because I'm an artist and I'm very fortunate. I mean, growing up in music and having seen my dad live through this, I feel like I've lived like two or three lifetimes already.
Sure.
Yeah, you don't, a lot of times I don't have to make the same mistakes that other people my age have to go through.
Sure.
And like, to discover something, like I already know like where certain roads are going to lead.
Yeah.
You know, and I know that there is an important role that producers and organizers and managers play in music and in art, you know. And they're not the people who have the camera on them all the time, and they're not the ones who end up on the front page of the magazine, but they're the ones who are helping, you know, people like Aretha Franklin choose the right songs, choose the right band, choose the right, you know, the right studios to record in. It's about you know, being part of the zeitgeist. It's about being like not you know, not so far outside of everything that nobody's even aware that you even exist.
Sure.
That would be frightening to me that something as important as New Orleans isn't even noticed because we don't care enough, you know, or that people look at New Orleans and they look at us as a charity instead of looking at us and being like, holy cow, man, these guys are making as good music as the Meters made.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, that's what I want to do. Like, I want to make as important music as Alan Toussaint made, as Dr. John made, as the Neville Brothers, as Professor Longhair, as Jelly Roll Morton, as Louis Armstrong. I mean, I wouldn't for a second say that I belong in that group, but that's who I'm trying to be.
Right.
You know,
and they didn't do it by staying in a closet and not getting
absolutely
out and experiencing and collaborating and riffing with
others. No, but they did it with honor and respect.
Right.
You know, Dr. John's not, I mean, he's not going to go mask on Mardi Gras Day, but ask him about the Indians, and he knows everything about the Indians. And he'll not just tell you about the Indians, but he's going to tell you whose uncle is related to whose cousins, related to so-and-so's brother-in-law, who was really the first person who did this. And you want to know something about Indian Red? Well, then you got to go talk to Danny Bark. You know, I mean, he's a griot.
So you know? So you say that at the last Super Sunday, Dr. John was sitting on a nondescript little fold-up chair with one other person on the neutral ground on Claiborne Avenue, wasn't dressed like, you know, he's Dr. John, so he's a little bit noticeable, but didn't have a flashy suit on, just sitting there like anybody else, people walking up saying hi, and that's exactly what he was doing.
Yeah.
He was telling everybody near him sort of the history of this and
then he'll tell you something about you that you didn't know, you know? And I mean, that's who I'm trying to be. Those are my models. You know, when you said Paul Prudhomme, you know, Paul Prudhomme's a model. He knew everybody in the restaurant business.
Yeah.
And everybody in the restaurant business knew him and respected him and went through him. You know, if you wanted to be somebody in the restaurant world, you had to be in that kitchen.
Yep.
You know?
That family tree. We just did an episode with Chef Frank Brightson.
Yes.
It's just a
family tree. There you go.
He's part of that. The Sonia is just reopened Gabrielle on Orleans over by Dookie Chase.
Yeah.
And all those ties. And as I hear you talking, the theme that comes through is that collaboration. And also honoring the tradition and being honored to be a part of it. And as I think about some of the more famous pop artists, if you will, that you guys have worked with over the last years, they strike me to a person, as you reel off those names, as people that honor and give great respect to the traditions that, you know, Dave Grohl comes in, and I don't think it's Dave Grohl comes in as the Foo Fighters and overshadows. If you read what he wrote then and what he talked about, it was so much about honoring and hoping to be a part of.
Well, that's what he came away with.
Space, right?
That's what he came away with. We wouldn't have done that project had I felt that Dave wasn't interested in expanding his knowledge of New Orleans. He somehow knew that New Orleans was an important musical city, and like we were still in the shadows of Katrina. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of where his musical knowledge of New Orleans ended, you know, because he's a punk rocker and he's a rock and roll guy. So to him, the Meters are kind of like a faint, distant kind of ripple, like this way, way far in the distance, you know. And so, you know, what he has though is this genuine sincerity to learn and to grow and to be like, I don't know anything. Like when I sat down with him for our interview, and I was the first one because he was trying to learn about New Orleans, you know, and he sat me down. I flew out to Los Angeles for it, and we sat down, and he goes, Ben, you know who I am. You know, I played with this band Nirvana, got this band Foo Fighters. We're a bunch of like loud rock and roll guys. I don't know anything about jazz. I really don't know anything about New Orleans. Roll tape, you know?
And no pressure, Ben.
And that's where it began. But it was also disarming. It was like, he's not trying to pretend that like, hey, I'm an authority on New Orleans music. He's right. Like, what do you know? Tell me what you know. What am I supposed to know about this place? And that's a true collaboration in my mind, is when someone can just humble themselves and be not, you don't even have to work to be humble. You're a humble human to the point of saying, I just want to know what you know. And you say, great, because I want to know what you know. And that week I learned more about being a band leader and about music and about running an organization and what it takes to be an artist and to be an engineer and to be a songwriter. I mean, he wrote a song in a week, you know, and he took it from interviews. I mean, just to watch his creative process throughout that week. And the whole time they're like, out, like, you know, gallivanting around the French Quarter and jumping on bikes, and like he's like, hey, we're hungry, where should we go, you know? And well, let's go around the corner. Okay, great. And like next thing you know, there's like a Foo Fighters parade to like, you know, a crawfish boil, or you know, or hop on our bikes and we like roll uptown to a second line, or you know, and like, you know, sing, you know, drinking Chablis on, you know, on, you know, Washington Avenue. I mean, it was a beautiful experience for all of us. And it reminded me also of how valuable and important these experiences that we grew up with and that we still have and that we work so hard to maintain and preserve after Katrina, how important they still are today.
Mm, yeah. Well, one of the reasons I wanted to do this talk with you was to really get into that and share with the listeners that it's easy to find, and we'll certainly, I've been a bit of a bad host, I haven't mentioned, but I'll put all the links in the show notes about preservationhall.com is where you can find everything, and you can get tickets, and we can talk briefly about that. Seven nights a week, several times a night, there are shows, but it's so much more than just the shows, and one of the
it's
things,
a foundation, it's working with children. When you walked in, I mean, we're talking about the Saints Go Marching In, that, you know, we had two workshops this morning with K through sixth graders, you know, today.
You guys have this great program.
Hundreds of kids a week come through Preservation Hall just sort of very quietly to have an experience. I'm very much about providing an experience. You know, it's that moment, you know, capturing a kid, a child at the right age, at the right moment, and you never know when that is. So you just always have to do it. You know, there's this moment where they look up and they see something that's like familiar to them, and it just captures them, and they're like, oh, Preservation Hall. Now I know that this can exist.
Yeah.
You know, I don't have to imagine that this can exist. I don't have to create it. This does exist, and I can just live a life knowing that I can somehow, a piece of this exists inside of me. You know, that's so important to me. I mean, it's not about like creating the next, you know, 100 jazz musicians, you know, they're already out there, and they're gonna figure it out just like I did, you know. So our foundation is really focused on having students have the experience of coming to Preservation Hall, just the same way that, you know, like, you know, Leonard Bernstein had like the, you know, classical concerts, and it's like, it's about awareness and it's about educating, but educating through the best kind of education is when you don't know you're learning.
Right.
You're just experiencing, and you're dancing and you're singing a song and you're singing the Saints Go Marching In, you know, and you're playing the tambourine and you're clapping. You know, I'm in there watching the kids. They're all clapping on 2 and 4 and dancing on the right beat. I'm like, well, guess what? I couldn't have taught you guys how to do that, but I'm giving you the stage to do that in, and with the musicians together, and now it's just another part of your life experience, and you're going to remember this for the rest of your life. And now, you know, 12 years later, after having, you know, our foundation up and running, there are, you know, we have students at
places like NOCA. I would imagine.
I mean, they've graduated NOCA already. I mean, they're like, you know, they're at Berkeley and they're at Juilliard,
wow.
And
yeah.
You know, they're all over the country. They're all over the world. And, you know, they come up to me at concerts all the time. You know, hey, I was one of those kids, and I was one of those things, and I saw you guys in the workshop. And 12 years is a long time.
Sure.
You know, that's an entire, like, you know, that's like an entire education.
Right.
You know?
Well, it strikes me the foundation is so much about education, and I think it's so important. It gets back to what you started with about honoring, giving an outlet for the culture to shine, and honoring that culture. When I was growing up here in New Orleans, pretty much every kid went through either band or choir. And that was public school and private school. And so you had that exposure. But that's slipping away today. And what you guys do with the foundation helps to keep that culture strong and to give people the opportunity. I often think one of the reasons we have so many great musicians in New Orleans is because every kid got exposure to music. And so naturally, some were going to gravitate up and be recognized. But everyone had an appreciation. And that's gone away. And I think what you guys are doing helps cultivate that in today's generation.
Well, you know, the appreciation for the arts is thicker in New Orleans than anywhere else in this country. That's no doubt about it. We are the shining beacon of light. We are a model city. Can it be better here? Absolutely. I mean, it can all be better, you know?
Yeah, sure. But
to understand that, like, you know, don't be that person that scratches your head and be like, man, there should be more, you know, there should be more music in schools. There should be more this, you know, no, you should be a part of it because it's already here. You have to be engaged. And that's, you know, that's when I put people to task is like, there's nothing to complain about. You know,
right. There's no excuse.
It's just because you haven't gotten involved yet. Mm-hmm. You know, it's all here. You have to make the effort to be involved. And that is your responsibility for being a member of this community, because this community is going to give you everything that you need in life.
That's so true, Ben. Thank you so much for taking the time. I know you have a busy schedule. You guys are busy here. But thanks so much for taking the time to
share
with us.
Appreciate it.
I'll put all the links over at beyondbourbonst.com/52. Links for how you can learn about the foundation, how you can get tickets when you come. We didn't even get into that, but I'll put it all there for you. And how you can be a part of continuing this tradition, continuing to honor it. Gosh, I enjoyed talking with Ben. The idea of honoring tradition just really hit home because we value our tradition so much here in New Orleans. It was awesome to walk in and hear the kids in the front room at Preservation Hall singing and enjoying the music of New Orleans. I was also extremely honored to be able to talk with Ben and to do it in the place where his parents called home. It really hit me while we were in that space how special it was, and I was just honored to be able to share that discussion with you. You can find the notes for today's episode over at beyondbourbonst.com/52, including the links to the Preservation Hall website. If you're in New Orleans and you have children, be sure to check out the foundation page where you can learn about the programs they have for kids. I'll definitely be getting our kids' school to take a trip to the hall. And, you know, of course, they're going to need parents as chaperones, right? Oh, and an insider tip. Check out the Big Shot passes if you don't want to wait in line for a Preservation Hall show. You buy them ahead of time online so you don't have to wait. Plus, you get a seat right up front. And if you've been to the hall, you know that it's often standing room only. There's not that many seats, and so the Big Shot Pass, I think, is well worth it. And it ranges from about $30 on up to like $50 for special events, so definitely worth checking it out. If you want to hear more shows like this one, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts, on Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes are available every other Wednesday. If you're enjoying the show, please share it with somebody else who loves New Orleans as much as you. We're going to have Richard Campanella back on soon as we approach New Orleans at 300, and we're working on a couple shows about the plantations, plus a whole lot more. Until next time, laissez le bon temps rouler, y'all.
Thanks for listening to the Beyond Bourbon Street podcast. Find us anytime at beyondbourbonst.com.